service panels, then had to be meticulously replaced in time for the next mission. If the crew screwed up, they'd lose a plane and a pilot, because one neglected indentation exposed to enemy radar acted like a neon pointer. The process was called buttering, using a special radar-absorbing putty we developed to coat uneven surfaces. The Air Force initially ordered 29 fighters. We built the first one in May 1981 and airlifted it out to our base for flight tests. The first flight confirmed a nagging doubt I had that we had made the twin V-shaped tails too damn small. Midway through that test program, one of the tails fluttered off. The test pilot was able to land after flying for several minutes, while actually unaware of what happened. "I thought the airplane acted a little sloppy," he told me later. His chase plane pilot had warned him, "Hey, I see one of your tails in free fall." We had to redesign the tail, which turned out to be 15% too small and too flexible for directional stability and control. Otherwise, the airplane handled well. Looking back, I am frankly amazed we didn't have many more major problems to fix than that one, because in truth, we were operating under chaotic conditions. Not only did we suffer all kinds of inefficiencies because of the tight security regulations, but most of the 1,000 production and shop workers building this airplane were starting from scratch at the Skunk Works. The best tribute to our homegrown training program was the astounding learning curve we achieved in the first couple of years. Building only 2 airplanes every 3 months, we enjoyed a better learning curve, 78%, than other manufacturers had reported while building 25 airplanes a month. The rule of thumb in the aerospace business was, the more you build, the better you get at it. Our view was that efficiency was mostly the result of quality training, careful inspection, supervision, and high worker motivation. And we achieved these efficiencies in the face of a glaring shortage of trained workers as the Reagan defense spending program began to accelerate in the 1981 to 1984 time period. The shortage became so severe that we borrowed tooling people from as far away as Lockheed's Georgia plant. By 1985, our workforce totaled a record 7,500 workers on a variety of stealth and non-stealth secret projects. During the same period, the aerospace industry in Southern California, including Hughes, Rockwell, McDonnell Douglas, Northrop, and Lockheed, had added about 45,000 workers to its payroll, as military aircraft revenues peaked at $33 billion in sales by 1986. The era of big defense-related profits was at hand. But there was always a price to pay when too many inexperienced workers were doing vital work on an airplane. On April 20, 1982, Major Whitley's stealth fighter was ready to take its Air Force acceptance flight out at the secret base. Whitley himself wanted to take the flight, but that was strictly against our rules. Our veteran test pilot Bob Riedenauer got the assignment. The airplane had performed perfectly during pre-delivery testing, but the night before the test flight, we relocated a servo mechanism from one equipment bay to another and rewired it. Riedenauer had barely lifted off the runway when he found to his horror that the wiring had accidentally reversed his crucial pitch and yaw controls. The airplane was only 30 feet off the deck when he flipped over backward and crashed on the side of the lake bed in a billowing cloud of dust. Bob was trapped in the cockpit and had to be cut free, sustaining serious leg injuries that kept him hospitalized 7 long and painful months. "Holy shit!" Major Whitley exclaimed. "That could have been me." We were both extremely shaken, but I was also hopping mad. That nearly fatal mistake should have been caught in the inspection process. Clearly, such an oversight compounded the original rewiring error. The Air Force convened an accident review board and noted that we had instituted new safeguards and inspection procedures within 48 hours of the accident. But the Air Force remained confident of the product, and Major Whitley finally took off for the first time in October 1982, flying the second production model. In honor of his maiden voyage, I presented him with a cryptically worded plaque that had to get by our security sensors. In recognition of a significant event, October 15th, 1982. Al left, but it would be 6 long years before he could finally explain to his wife and kids what in hell that plaque's inscription really meant. "You kept your promise," Whitley said to me. I had a slight anxiety attack rolling down that runway, but as soon as I was airborne and those wheels were sucked up, the ride was pure exhilaration. The stealth fighter became operational 1 year later. By then, the Air Force had decided to expand its deployment on a global scale for a total of 59 stealth fighters to comprise 3 squadrons of a special and secret wing. One squadron would be deployed to England for coverage of Western Europe, the Middle East, the Soviet Union, and Eastern Europe. A second squadron would be sent to South Korea to provide standby attack capabilities throughout Asia. The third squadron would be in training stateside. We delivered 33 airplanes by 1986, and the remaining 26 by the middle of 1990. We built 8 a year at a flyaway cost of $43 million each. Stealth did not come cheap, but considering the revolutionary nature of the product and the enormous strategic advantages it afforded, the F-117A was the most cost-effective new weapons system in the inventory. The first stealth fighter squadron, composed of 18 airplanes and a few spares, was ready to go to battle only 5 years after the initial Air Force go-ahead, suffering only one non-fatal crash in the process. Other voices. Colonel Alton Whitley. The F-117A was the nation's best-kept secret. Only a very small number of Air Force brass even knew that we existed. The Pentagon located us in one of the most desolate spots in North America, on a remote, high-desert airstrip originally used by the Sandia National Laboratories for nuclear warhead testing. It was part of the Nellis Air Force Base test range, about 140 miles from Las Vegas, an uninhabited area of undulating plains and scrub with looming high Sierra foothills in the far distance. The nearest town, about 20 miles away, was called Tonopah. Only the Lord knows how many other secret government projects were tucked away in remote corners of that huge test range, the size of Switzerland. But we figured we were far from alone out there. Wild Mustangs roamed freely through the desert scrub and galloped across our runways. Big scorpions scuttled around the day rooms and inside the new hangars we built to hide our airplanes from Soviet satellites. Colonel Berner Bob Jackson saw an advertisement in the Wall Street Journal by Chevron out of Canada offering to sell its temporary cold-weather trailer units from a discontinued oil patch for $10 million. Jackson flew up there and bought the whole thing for $1 million and had it shipped down to Tonopah, and that became our first temporary housing. But over the years, the Air Force poured $300 million into the base, building 3 runways and transformed it into a very major facility, complete with gym and indoor pool. Before that base was ready, and before we had enough fighters ready to fly, our newly formed squadron took over a remote corner of Nellis Air Force Base and spent our time flying A-7 attack fighters. The A-7s became our cover. In early 1984, we deployed in A-7s to Kunsan Air Base in South Korea to test our deployment procedures to the Far East, ahead of the F-117A squadron that would be sent there. The word was purposely leaked that our A-7 fighters were carrying super-secret atomic anti-radar devices that would render the airplane invisible to enemy defenses. To maintain the deception, we outfitted each plane with old napalm canisters painted black and flashing a red danger light in the rear. It carried a radiation warning tag over an ominous-looking slot on which was printed, "Reactor Cooling Fill Port." When we deployed, carrying these bogus devices, air police closed down the base and ringed the field with machine gun-toting jeeps. They forced all the runway crews to turn their backs on our airplanes as they taxied past, and actually had them spread-eagled on the deck with their eyes closed until our squadron took off. Real crazy stuff, but the deception actually worked. When we finally moved into Tonopah in 1984, we kept A-7s parked on the ramp so that Soviet satellites would think we were an A-7 base. But if their photo analysis experts were really on the ball, they would have picked up the double fencing around the perimeter. The powerful searchlights, television cameras, and sensing devices, all signs of unusually tight security. And I think they may have picked this up because satellite overpasses increased to as many as 3 or 4 a day for weeks on end. They were looking for something special, but we did all our real work well after sundown. We called ourselves the Nighthawks, which became the official nickname of our 37th Tactical Fighter Wing. For years on end, we were forced to live like vampire bats in a dark cave. We slept all day behind thick blackout curtains and began to stir only when the sun went down. The F-117A is a night attack plane using no radio, no radar, and no lights. The Skunk Works stripped the fighter of every electronic device that could be picked up by ground-to-air defenses. The engines were muffled to eliminate noise. We flew below 30,000 feet to avoid contrails on moonlit nights. We carried no guns or air-to-air missiles, because the airplane wasn't designed for high-performance maneuvering, but to slip inside hostile territory, drop its two bombs, and get the hell out of there. So nights were meant for stealth, and we spent 5 nights a week practicing bombing runs and air-to-air refueling above the remote test range. We started work 2 hours after sunset and finished 2 hours before sunrise. Whenever the airplane left the hangar lights had to be turned off. No landing field lights were allowed. Our families had no idea about where we took off to every Monday or where we returned from every Friday evening. Most of us were family men who lived on base housing at Nellis just outside Las Vegas. Going home on weekends by charter flights into Nellis was rough because we led normal lives for 2 days with our wives and kids before reverting to night-stalking vampires again. Marriages were really put to a severe test. In cases of emergency, wives would call a special number at Nellis and ask us to call home. I know it sounds corny, but our morale stayed high because our task was to keep 12 airplanes on standby alert to go to war on the instant command of the President of the United States. Only the President or his Secretary of Defense could unleash us. And the second reason our morale stayed high was the airplane itself. All of us who flew it got to fall in love. We all agreed that if we flew within the assigned mission and stayed within the flight envelope, the stealth fighter was a sweetheart, absolutely superb, and we all became proficient using smart and precise laser-guided bombs. We carried a pair of 2,000-pounders that would follow our laser guide beam right into the heart of a target as we lined it up on crosshairs on our cabin video screen. We could find Mrs. Smith's rooming house and take out the northeast corner guest room above the garage. That kind of precision was awesome to behold. I was made colonel in early 1990, and by mid-summer became the wing commander just in time for our early August deployment to Saudi Arabia. And a few months after that, we struck the first blow in Operation Desert Storm. Ben Rich. A year after the stealth fighter became operational, two computer wizards who worked in our threat analysis section came to me with a fascinating proposition. Ben, why don't we make the stealth fighter automated from takeoff to attack and return? We can plan the entire mission on computers, transfer it onto a cassette that the pilot loads into his onboard computers. That will route him to the target and back and leave all the driving to us. To my amazement, they actually developed this automated program in only 120 days, and at a cost of only $2.5 million. It was so advanced over any other program that the Air Force bought it for use in all their attack airplanes. At the heart of the system were two powerful computers that detailed every aspect of a mission, upgraded with the latest satellite-acquired intelligence, so that the plan routes a pilot around the most dangerous enemy radar and missile locations. When the cassette was loaded into the airplane system, it permitted hands-off flying through all turning points, altitude changes, and airspeed adjustments. Incredibly, the computer program actually turned the fighter at certain angles to maximize its stealthiness to the ground at dangerous moments during a mission, when it would be in range of enemy missiles, and got the pilot over his target after a 1,000-mile trip with split-second precision. Once over the target, a pilot could override the computers, take control, and guide his two bombs to target by infrared video imagery. Otherwise, our autopiloted computer was programmed even to drop his bombs for him. It took us about 2 years to really perfect this system, aided by the nightly training flights at Tonopah. The computerized auto system was so effective that on a typical training flight, Pilots were targeting particular apartments in a Cleveland high-rise or a boathouse at the edge of some remote Wisconsin lake and scoring perfect simulated strikes. The first chance to test the airplane and the system under real combat conditions came in April 1986, when the squadron received top-secret orders directly from Caspar Weinberger, Reagan's defense secretary, to be prepared for a Delta Force-style nighttime strike against Libya's Muammar Gaddafi's headquarters in Tripoli. The mission was codenamed Operation El Dorado Canyon and would involve 8 to 12 F-117As. Preparations were immediately made to fly to the East Coast, overnight for crew rest, then take off the next day and, using air-to-air refueling, fly straight to Libya and hit Gaddafi around 3 in the morning. Senior officers at the Tactical Air Command, who had been briefed about the existence of the stealth fighter and were monitoring the training program underway at Tonopah, advised Weinberger that the F-117A was the perfect weapon system for this covert surgical strike operation. "This was why the system was built," one four-star declared. But Cap hesitated, and within an hour of the squadron's scheduled departure to the East Coast, he scrubbed us from the mission. He simply did not want to reveal the existence of this top-secret revolutionary airplane to the Russians that soon. In my view, Weinberger booted it. The raid was carried out using Navy fighter bombers off carriers, and Gaddafi escaped with his life because Libyan defenses picked up the attackers coming in time to sound the alarm, and several bombs aimed directly at Gaddafi's quarters missed their target because the attacking aircraft were forced to evade incoming missiles and flak. The F-117A would have attacked with surprise and placed that smart bomb right on the guy's pillow. The Defense Department reluctantly revealed the stealth fighter's existence in 1988. The time had come to expand training operations to include other Air Force units, and the Pentagon intelligence analysts concluded that the Soviets already knew the airplane was in the inventory. Although the press had speculated about the existence of a stealth fighter for years, what it actually looked like, its crucial shape and design, remained safely secret. The press even called it the F-19, the wrong designation, and published speculative artists' renditions that caused our experts like Dennis Overholzer and Dick Cantrell to laugh in glee. Still, I knew several high-level intelligence officials who were miffed that the Air Force officially unveiled the airplane at all. "The Russians," they told me, "are worried and puzzled. They don't have a clue about how to counter the F-117A. We've got them burning lights and working weekends. Much better, though, if we kept it under wraps until we hit them with it." Other voices. General Larry D. Welch, Air Force Chief of Staff, 1986 to 1990. "As Air Force Chief of Staff, what I had in mind for the F-117A was a specific set of extremely high-value targets that would neutralize the enemy defenses for a full-scale attack. For example, we had pondered endlessly about how we could cope with the Soviet SA-5 and SA-10 ground-to-air missiles. That is, by what means could we take them out and allow our air armada to proceed safely to their targets inside the Soviet heartland? We finally determined that the stealth airplane was our ticket. If we had a squadron of these revolutionary airplanes that no one knew about, if they could take out those damned SA-5s, that gave us a tremendous strategic advantage over the Russians. As it turned out, we had a rather limited and myopic vision of what the airplane was really capable of. The conflict with Iraq proved it was far more versatile in undertaking all sorts of attack missions than any of us had ever imagined. Before the F-117A flew on the first night of combat in Operation Desert Storm, we had been forced to ponder how many days and sorties it would require before we could grind down enemy air defenses to the point where we could conduct a full-scale air campaign. The combination of stealth, with its high-precision munitions, provided an almost total assurance that we could destroy enemy defenses from day one, and the air campaign could be swift and almost devoid of any losses. In the past, you would have been betting your hat, ass, and spats on a lot of wishful thinking to conceive a battle plan that would eliminate most of the highest-value enemy targets over the most heavily defended city on Earth on the opening night of the war. But that's exactly what Ben Rich's airplane did on the first night of Desert Storm. For me, the shining moment came on live television, when that F-117A placed a bomb right down the air shaft of the Iraqi Defense Ministry, with the whole world watching. Think about the impact that hit had on the entire Iraqi leadership. And I'm certain that in every defense ministry around the world, there was an instant recognition that something astonishing had taken place, with implications for future air warfare that were impossible to imagine. Donald Rice, Secretary of the Air Force from 1989 to 1992. I was at the Pentagon the night that Operation Desert Storm kicked off. H-Hour was scheduled to begin precisely at 3 a.m. Baghdad time with precision raids staged by the F-117As. The timing had to be exact, and we had planned this opening raid for weeks, so we were all disconcerted to suddenly see CNN going live to Baghdad at 20 minutes to 3 to report that the city was under attack. There were three CNN reporters in a hotel room, Bernard Shaw, John Holloman, and Peter Arnett, delivering excited accounts of cruise missiles streaking past and sounds of attack airplanes overhead. The sky was alive with tracers. This went on for 20 minutes, during which not a thing was actually happening in the skies over Baghdad. Absolutely nothing. With the exception of the F-117s, which had been sent ahead and were already past the Iraqi border on their way to attack Baghdad, the remainder of the Allied air armada was purposely being held back and out of range of a string of three early warning radar stations inside Iraq, near the Saudi border. We sent in Apache attack helicopters to take them out, and that attack was launched at 21 minutes to 3. Apparently someone radioed back to Baghdad, "We're being attacked!" In Baghdad, they reacted by immediately firing everything they owned into the night skies. Finally, at 1 minute past 3, one of the three CNN reporters said, "Whoops, the phone in our room just went dead." A minute later, at 2 minutes after 3, the lights in that hotel room went out. That told us that the real attack had actually begun. We had pre-planned that at 2 minutes after 3, the first F-117s would take out the telephone center and central power station in downtown Baghdad. And that's how we learned back in Washington that the leading elements of the F-117 attack force had dropped their precision bombs exactly on time. We learned that night, and for many nights after that, that stealth, combined with precision weapons, constituted a quantum advance in air warfare. Ever since World War II, when radar systems first came into play, air warfare planners thought that surprise attacks were rendered null and void, and thought in terms of large armadas to overwhelm the enemy and get a few attack aircraft through to do damage. Now we again think in small numbers, and in staging surprise, surgically precise raids. Looking ahead, I'd predict that by the first couple of decades of the next century, every military aircraft flying would be stealth. I might be wrong about the date, but not about the dominance of stealth. Colonel Barry Horn. Bats. Bats were the first visual proof I had that stealth really worked. We had deployed 37 F-117As to the King Khalid Air Base in a remote corner of Saudi Arabia out of the range of Saddam's Scuds, about 900 miles from downtown Baghdad. The Saudis provided us with a first-class fighter base with reinforced hangars, and at night, the bats would come out and feed off insects. In the mornings, we'd find bat corpses littered around our airplanes inside the open hangars. Bats used a form of sonar to see at night, and they were crashing blindly into our low-radar cross-section tails. After all those years of training, we certainly believed in the product, but it was nice having that kind of visual confirmation nevertheless. On the night of D-Day in Desert Storm, it fell on us to hit first. Most of us felt like firefighters about to test a flame-retardant shield by walking into a wall of fire. The so-called experts assured us that the suit worked, but we really wouldn't know for sure until we made that fateful walk. As we suited up to fly into combat for the first time, one of the other pilots whispered to me, "Well, I sure hope to God that stealth shit really works." He spoke for us all. H-Hour for Desert Storm was 3 a.m. Baghdad time, January 17, 1991. I climbed into my airplane shortly after midnight. Frankly, I don't think you could have driven a needle up my sphincter using a sledgehammer. From all our briefings, we knew that we would be running up against the greatest concentration of AAA and missile ground fire since the Vietnam War, or maybe even in history. Saddam Hussein had 16,000 missiles and 3,000 anti-aircraft emplacements in and around Baghdad, more than the Russians had protecting Moscow. The F-117A was the only coalition airplane that would be used to hit Baghdad in this war. We got the missions most hazardous to a pilot's health. Otherwise, the plan was to hit Saddam's capital with Navy Tomahawk missiles fired from ships at sea. Each of us carried two hardened, laser-guided 2,000-pounders, designed to penetrate deep into enemy bunkers before exploding. They were called GBU-27s, and only the F-117As carried them. The mission took us 5 hours, with three air-to-air refuelings. We came at Baghdad in two waves. 10 F-117As in the first wave to knock out key communication centers, and then the second wave of 12 airplanes an hour or so later. The skies over Baghdad looked like three dozen 4th of July celebrations rolled into one. Only it was a curtain of steel that represented blind firing. They could detect us, but they couldn't track us. We were like mosquitoes buzzing around their ears, and they furiously swatted at us blindly. They just hoped for a golden BB, a lucky blind shot that would hit home, and I couldn't see how they could possibly miss. The only analogy I could think of was being on a ramp above an exploding popcorn factory and not having one kernel hit you. The law of averages alone would have made that impossible, and so I prayed. That first night, we saw French-built F-1s and Soviet MiG-29s flying around on our sensor displays, but they gave no sign of ever seeing us. There were five communication sectors in the country, so we didn't have to destroy all their missiles or airplanes, but knock out their brains and claw out their eyes. So we hit their missile and communication centers, their operational commands, and their air defense center. In only three bombing raids that lasted a total of about 20 minutes, combined with attacks from Tomahawk missiles, we absolutely knocked Iraq out of the war. From that first night, they were incapable of launching retaliatory airstrikes or sustaining any real defenses against our air power. All they had left were mobile Scud missiles, a primitive revenge weapon, and vulnerable ground troops who had to fight in the open without air cover or hope. To put it in domestic terms, if Baghdad had been Washington, that first night we knocked out their White House, their Capitol building, their Pentagon, their CIA and FBI, took out their telephone and telegraph facilities, damaged Andrews, Langley, and Bowling air bases, and punched big holes in all their key Potomac River bridges. And that was just the first night. We went back night after night over the next month. We flew in twos, but you don't see your partner. So the guys that first night saw the skies over Baghdad and just figured we'd lost airplanes and pilots. Then, once safely back across the border, we joined up and saw that everyone was okay, and we were amazed, overjoyed, and deeply moved. No one had suffered as much as a hit or even a near miss. That stealth shit had really worked. Major Miles Pound. It took only about two or three missions before most of us didn't even bother to glance out at the flak bursting all around us. We took advantage of their blind firing. We'd delay an attack 5 minutes, knowing they'd have to stop firing to cool down their guns. Then we'd come in and hit them. We drew all the demanding high-precision bombing of the most heavily defended, highest-priority targets. The powers that be decided to use B-52s to pour down bombs on the big North Taji military-industrial complex. But it was protected by surface-to-air missiles that could knock down our bombing armada. So we went in the night before and took out all 15 missile sites using 10 stealth airplanes. They never saw us coming. That mission won us a standing ovation from General Schwarzkopf and the other brass monitoring us back in the coalition war room. Given our precision bombs, we could locate the one communications node in a city block and take it out without inflicting collateral damage. We used to brag, "Just tell us whether you want to hit the men's room or the ladies' room and we'll oblige." Because of stealth, we could arrive at target unseen and focus entirely on making a precision hit. Our GBU-27 laser-guided bomb could penetrate the most hardened bunker. We hit Saddam's Sumara chemical bunkers with these bombs. They were 8 feet of reinforced concrete, and we used the first bomb to pierce through the dense construction. Then a second bomb followed down the same drilled hole made by the first and exploded with tremendous impact. About halfway through the war, we began running low on bomb supplies and reverted to using a lighter bomb. Those GBU-10s bounced right off the roof of some hardened hangars at a forward Iraqi airbase called H-2. Intelligence reported the Iraqis were gleeful, felt they had finally defeated us at something. So they crammed these hangars with as many of their remaining jet fighters as they could. We waited for a couple of days, then went in with our heavier GBU-27s and blew that damned airbase off the map. Three other missions I remember with a lot of relish. We did some high-precision bombing and took out a Republican Guard barracks at a prison camp housing Kuwaiti prisoners, allowing them to escape. On another night, we took out Peter Arnett of CNN. I was at the base watching him broadcast. That guy was not wildly popular with many of us because we felt Saddam was just using him for propaganda, and we knew that in exactly 6 seconds, our guys were going to hit the telecommunications center in downtown Baghdad and knock Arnett off the air. So we began counting out 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The screen went blank. Right on cue, too. We cheered like nuts at a football game. But the raid against Saddam's nuclear research facility, which also had capability for chemical and biological weapons production, probably proved stealth at its best. The Air Force went after that place in daylight, using an armada of 72 airplanes, including 14 attack F-16s, and the rest escorts, jammers, and tankers needed to support such an operation with conventional aircraft. Those pilots saw more SAMs and AAAs coming up at them than they cared ever to remember. The Iraqis covered the target with smoke generators so that our guys had no choice but to drop bombs into the smoke and scoot for their lives. They scored no hits. We came in at 3 a.m, using only 8 airplanes and needing only 2 tankers to get us there and back, and took out 3 of the 4 nuclear reactors and heavily damaged the 4th. Once that first bomb hit, all hell broke loose. I dropped my bombs, but I couldn't get my bomb bay door closed. That was as bad as it could get, because a right angle is like a spotlight to ground radar, and a bomb bay door is a perfect right angle. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw a missile firing up at me. I had one hand on the eject lever and the other trying to manually close that stalled bomb bay. As the missile closed on me, the door finally did too, and I watched that missile curve harmlessly by me as it lost me in its homing. About an hour later, I began breathing again. Ben Rich. The night of that first raid against Baghdad coincided with a farewell banquet Lockheed staged to mark my retirement as head of the Skunk Works. It was a very emotional and patriotic evening, interspersed with the latest bulletins and live coverage from CNN. Early the next morning, my son Michael called me and read me a story from the New York Times reporting that the first F-117A to drop a bomb on Baghdad carried a small American flag in its cockpit that later would be presented to me. The story said that the pilots of the 37th Tactical Fighter Wing had dedicated that first airstrike to me in honor of my retirement. Even more gratifying was that stealth lived up to all our expectations and claims. In spite of undertaking the most dangerous missions of that war, not one F-117A was hit by enemy fire. I know that Colonel Whitley had privately estimated losses of 5 to 10% in the first month of the air campaign. No one expected to escape without any losses at all. The stealth fighters composed only 2% of the total Allied air assets in action, and they flew 1,271 missions, only 1% of the total coalition air sorties, but accounted for 40% of all damaged targets attacked, and compiled a 75% direct hit rate. The direct hit rate was almost as boggling as the no-casualty rate, since laser-guided bombs are strictly line of sight, depending on good visibility, and the air war was conducted during some of the worst weather in the region in memory. The airplane was used at first as a silver bullet against high-value targets. They dropped the first bombs and opened the door for everyone else by destroying the Iraqi communications network. Those attacks were shown to the American public on CNN, and the political impact was as great as the military. It showed we could go downtown at will, and with the precision of threading the eye of a needle, take out the enemy military command centers with terrific accuracy. Those bullseye shots kept the public's morale high and its backing secure. No shootdowns, no prisoners, no hostages. Gradually, stealth missions were broadened to include air bases and bridges. Bridges are the most difficult target to destroy unless hit in a precise spot with the right payload. To bring down some bridges in Vietnam, for example, took thousands of sorties. The F-117A knocked out 39 of the 43 bridges spanning the Tigris-Euphrates River. Simply astounding. Stealth opened a new frontier in air war, proving that night attacks were more effective and less dangerous than daylight raids, where aircraft can be seen by the eye as well as by electronics. But Operation Desert Storm also raised red flag warnings about future air combat. 1 month seemed to be the logistical limit to air combat sorties. We didn't design our airplanes to fly 5 hours a day, every day for a month or more. Pilot fatigue and a shortage of spare parts became a growing concern. We almost ran out of bombs, too. But the overriding fact of Desert Storm was that the only way the enemy knew the F-117A was in the sky above was when everything around him began blowing up. 5. How We Skunks Got Our Name. I first showed up at Kelly Johnson's front door in December 1954 as a 29-year-old thermodynamicist earning $87 a week. I had never before set foot inside the so-called Skunk Works in Building 82, a barn-like airplane assembly facility next to the Burbank Airport's main runway, where Kelly and his minions held forth in a warren of cramped offices, oblivious to the outside world. Everything about that operation was secret, even what building they were in. All I knew for sure was that Johnson had called over to the main plant where I had been working for the past 4 years, and asked to borrow a thermodynamicist, preferably a smart one, to help him solve some unspecified problems. It was like a bandleader calling over to the union hall to hire a xylophone player for a one-nighter. My expertise was solving heat problems and designing inlet and exhaust ducts on airplane engines. In those years, Lockheed was booming, cranking out a new airplane every 2 years. I felt I was in on the ground floor of a golden age in aviation, the era of the jet airplane, and couldn't believe my good luck. As young and green as I was, I had already earned my very own patent for designing a nichrome wire to wrap around and electrically heat the urine elimination tube used on Navy patrol planes. Crewmen complained that on freezing winter days, their penises were sticking painfully to the metal funnel. My design solved their problem, and I'm sure made me their unknown hero. Both my design and patent were classified secret. My input was far less dramatic working on America's first supersonic jet fighter, the F-104 Starfighter, nicknamed by the press, the missile with the man in it, in tribute to its blazing Mach 2 speed. I helped design the inlet ducts on that, as well as on our first military jet transport, the C-130, and on the F-90. The latter was a stainless steel jet fighter, capable of pulling 12G loads during incredible dives and turns, but was woefully underpowered since the engine originally designed for it was canceled by the Air Force for budgetary reasons. So the F-90 wound up serving the country by being shipped to Ground Zero at the Nevada Atomic Test Site at a mock military base specially constructed to determine how various structures and military equipment would withstand an A-bomb explosion. The short answer was everything was either vaporized or blown to pieces except for the F-90. Its windshield was vaporized, its paint sandblasted, but otherwise our steel airplane survived in one piece. That sucker was built. The projects at Lockheed were all big-ticket items, and workrooms as big as convention halls were crammed with endless rows of white-shirted draftsmen, working elbow to elbow at drafting tables. We engineers sat elbow to elbow, too, but in smaller rooms and a slightly less regimented atmosphere. We were the analytical experts, the elite of the plant, who decreed sizes and shapes and told the draftsmen what to draw. All of us were well aware that we worked for Chief Engineer Clarence Kelly Johnson, the living legend who had designed Lockheed's Electra and Lockheed's Constellation, the two most famous commercial airliners in the world. All of us had seen him rushing around in his untucked shirt, a paunchy middle-aged guy with a comical duck's waddle, slick down white hair and a belligerent jaw. He had a thick round nose that reminded me a lot of W.C. Fields, but without the humor. Definitely without that. Johnson was all business and had the reputation of an ogre who ate young tender engineers for between-meal snacks. We peons viewed him with the knee-knocking dread and awe of the Almighty, best described in the Old Testament. The guy would just as soon fire you as have to chew on you for some goof-up. Right or not, that was the lowdown on Kelly Johnson. One day in my second year on the job, I looked up from my desk and found myself staring right into the face of the chief engineer. I turned pale, then crimson. Kelly was holding a drawing of an inlet I had designed. He was neither angry nor unkind while handing it back to me. "It will be way too draggy, Rich, the way you designed this. It's about 20% too big. Refigure it." Then he was gone. I spent the rest of the day refiguring and discovered that the inlet was 18% too big. Kelly had figured it out in his head, by tuition or maybe just experience. Either way, I was damned impressed. In those days, Kelly wore his chief engineer's hat until around 2 in the afternoon, then drove off to the Skunk Works, which was about half a mile down the road, tucked away inside the Lockheed complex, and spent the final 2 hours of his workday doing his secret design and development work. There were always plenty of rumors about what Kelly was up to, designing atomic-powered bombers or rocket-driven supersonic fighters. Supposedly, he had a dozen engineers working for him, and we in the main plant pitied those guys who were under that brutal thumb. Still, the truth was, I welcomed the chance to get out of the main plant for a while. Lockheed was very regimented and bureaucratic, and by my fourth year on the payroll, I felt stymied and creatively frustrated. I had a wife and a new baby son to support, and my father-in-law, who admired my moxie, was pushing me to take over his bakery delicatessen, which earned the family a very comfortable living. I had actually given notice to Lockheed, but at the last moment changed my mind. I loved building airplanes a lot more than baking bagels or curing corned beef. So I was eager to experience Kelly's Skunk Works, even if I was only on loan to him for a few weeks. It never occurred to me that I had any chance at all to stay there permanently. I was well-trained in my engineering specialty and actually had taught thermodynamics at UCLA before joining Lockheed. I was also a naturalized American citizen and intensely patriotic, and welcomed the chance to work on secret projects designed to defeat the Russians. I had plenty of self-assurance, and figured that as long as I did a good job, Kelly Johnson would behave himself. As fearsome as Kelly was supposed to be, I knew he would be a pushover compared to my own stern father, Isidore Rich, a British citizen who had been, until the outbreak of World War II, the superintendent of a hardwood lumber mill in Manila, the Philippines, where I was born and raised. The Riches were among the first Jewish families to settle in Manila, and after one of my paternal grandfather's business trips to Egypt, he brought back a snapshot of the beautiful young daughter of one of his Jewish customers to show to my bachelor father. My father was enchanted, and a flirtatious correspondence bloomed into a full-fledged romance. Marriage followed a few years later. My mother Annie was a French citizen, born and raised in Alexandria, a brilliant linguist who spoke 13 languages fluently, a free spirit who pampered me as her second youngest among 4 sons and 1 daughter. Mother was the opposite of our authoritarian father, who ruled over us like a biblical prophet and used a strap to enforce his commandments. We lived in a big house with lots of servants on my father's very modest middle-class salary, enjoying a way of life that was patently colonial and exploitive of the locals, but wonderfully secure and languid as the tropical air itself. My parents dressed formally to dine at their club and play bridge. We raised 23 police dogs in our huge backyard that resembled a tropical rainforest. And in later years, I amused Kelly with the story of how I built my first airplane at the tender age of 14. An older cousin bought a Piper Cub from a local flying club, and to his dismay discovered that it came in a dozen crates and that he had to assemble it himself. My brothers and I built it for him in our big backyard, and after weeks of hard labor we discovered that the finished product was too big to fit through our front gate. We had to take off the wings, but still no go. Then the tail, and finally the landing gear. In the end, we recrated the damn thing, and my cousin got his money back. A few years later, that same cousin barely survived the infamous Bataan Death March. By then, my family and I were safe in Los Angeles, having fled the island only a few months before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. As tough as it was starting life anew, none of us were complaining. My father's sister, who had weighed a hefty 150 pounds before the war, emerged from a Japanese prison camp as a gaunt, 80-pound skeleton. During the war years, my father and I worked in a Los Angeles machine shop to keep the family going. I was able to start college only after the war ended, and I was already 21. So I gave up my dream of becoming a doctor, like my father's brother, who was a world authority on tropical medicine, and decided to become an engineer instead. I graduated from Berkeley in mechanical engineering in 1949, in the top 20 in a class of 3,000, and decided to go on for my master's at UCLA, specializing in both aerothermodynamics and dating sorority girls. By then, I had met my future wife, a beautiful young fashion model named Faye Mayer, who had an incomprehensible weakness for skinny engineers who smoked pipes. We got married just in time for me to start job hunting in the middle of the painful post-war recession and discover that a UCLA hotshot with a master's degree was just another candidate for unemployment. But one of my professors tipped me off to an engineer job opening at Lockheed's Burbank plant. I was hired and worked under Bernie Messenger, Lockheed's heat transfer specialist, when Kelly had phoned Bernie asking him to borrow a competent thermodynamicist for an undisclosed Skunk Works project. Bernie tapped me. Since its inception back in 1943, when the first German jet fighters appeared in the air war over Europe, the Skunk Works had been entirely Kelly's domain. The War Department had turned to Lockheed's then 33-year-old chief engineer to build a jet fighter prototype, because he had designed and built the twin-engine P-38 Lightning, the most maneuverable propeller-driven fighter of the war. Kelly was given only 180 days to build that jet prototype, designed to fly at 600 miles per hour, at least 200 miles per hour faster than the P-38, at the very edge of the speed of sound. Kelly set to work by borrowing 23 of the best available design engineers and about 30 shop mechanics at the main plant. They operated under strict wartime secrecy, so that when he discovered that all available floor space in the Lockheed complex was taken for round-the-clock fighter and bomber production, that suited Johnson just fine. He rented a big circus tent and set up shop next to a noxious plastics factory, whose stench kept the curious at bay. Around the time Kelly's crew raised their circus tent, cartoonist Al Capp introduced Injun Joe and his backwoods still into his Lil Abner comic strip. Old Joe tossed worn shoes and dead skunk into his smoldering vat to make Kickapoo Joy Juice. Cap named the outdoor still the Skunk Works. The connection was apparent to those inside Kelly's circus tent, forced to suffer the plastic factory's stink. One day, one of the engineers showed up for work wearing a civil defense gas mask as a gag, and a designer named Irv Culver picked up a ringing phone and announced, "Skunk Works." Kelly overheard him and chewed out Irv for ridicule. "Culver, you're fired," Kelly roared. "Get your ass out of my tent." Kelly fired guys all the time without meaning it. Irv Culver showed up for work the next day, and Kelly never said a word. Behind his back, all of Kelly's workers began referring to the operation as the Skunk Works, and soon everyone at the main plant was calling it that, too. When the wind was right, they could smell that skunk. In 1960, Cap's publisher objected to our use of Skunk Works, so we changed it to Skunk Works and registered the name and logo as trademarks. It is listed in the Random House Dictionary, often a secret experimental division, laboratory, or project for producing innovative design or products in the computer or aerospace field. And who knows? Maybe it was that smell that spurred Kelly's guys to build Lulu Bell, their nickname for the cigar-shaped prototype of the P-80 shooting star, in only 143 days, 37 days ahead of schedule. The war ended in Europe before the P-80 could prove itself there, but Lockheed built nearly 9,000 over the next 5 years, and during the Korean War, the P-80 won the first all-jet dogfight, shooting down a Soviet MiG-15 in the skies above North Korea. That primitive Skunk Works operation set the standards for what followed. The project was highly secret, very high priority, and time was of the essence. The Air Corps had cooperated to meet Dolph Kelly's needs and then got out of his way. Only two officers were authorized to peek inside Kelly's tent flaps. Lockheed's management agreed that Kelly could keep his tiny research and development operation running, the first in the aviation industry, as long as it was kept on a shoestring budget and didn't distract the chief engineer from his principal duties. So Kelly and a handful of bright young designers he selected took over some empty space in Building 82. Kelly dropped by for an hour or two every day before going home. Those guys brainstormed what-if questions about the future needs of commercial and military aircraft, and if one of their ideas resulted in a contract to build an experimental prototype, Kelly would borrow the best people he could find in the main plant to get the job done. That way the overhead was kept low and the financial risks to the company stayed small. Fortunately for Kelly, the risks stayed small because his first two development projects following the P-80 were absolute clunkers. He designed and built a prototype for a small, low-cost-per-mile transport airplane called the Saturn that was really a sixth toe on commercial aviation's foot because the airlines were buying the cheap war surplus C-47 cargo plane to haul their customers and were calling it the DC-3. Then Kelly and his little band of brainstormers designed the damnedest airplane ever seen, the XFV-1, a vertical riser to test the feasibility of vertical takeoff and landing from the deck of a ship. The big trouble, impossible to overcome, was that the pilot was forced to look straight up at the sky at the crucial moment when his airplane was landing on deck. Even Kelly had to concede the unsolvability of that one. But the open secret in our company was that the chief engineer walked on water in the adoring eyes of CEO Robert Gross. Back in 1932, Gross had purchased Lockheed out of bankruptcy for $40,000 and staked the company's survival on the development of a twin-engine commercial transport. Models of the design were sent to the wind tunnel labs at the University of Michigan, where a young engineering student named Clarence Johnson contradicted the positive findings of his faculty advisors, who praised the design to Lockheed's engineering team. Johnson, all of 23, warned Lockheed's chief engineer at the time that the design was inherently directionally unstable, especially with one engine out. Lockheed was sufficiently impressed to hire the presumptuous young engineer and learned quickly why this son of Swedish immigrants was nicknamed Kelly by his school chums years earlier. He might be stubborn as a Swede, but his temper was definitely old sod. Kelly solved the Electra instability problem with an unconventional twin-tail arrangement that soon became his and Lockheed's trademark. The Electra revolutionized commercial aviation in the 1930s. Meanwhile, Kelly was the shining light in the company's six-man aviation department, the expert aerodynamicist, stress analyst, weight expert, wind tunnel, and flight test engineer. And he did some test flying himself. He once said that unless he had the hell scared out of him once a year in a cockpit, he wouldn't have the proper perspective to design airplanes. Once that guy made up his mind to do something, he was as relentless as a bowling ball heading toward a 10-pin strike. With his chili pepper temperament, he was poison to any bureaucrat, a disaster to ass-coverers, excuse-makers, or fault-finders. Hall Hibbard, who was Kelly's first boss at Lockheed, watched Kelly work for 3 days during the war to transform Lockheed's Electra into a bomber for the British, called the Hudson. The transformation was so successful that the RAF ordered 3,000 airplanes, and Hibbard was so awestruck by Johnson's design skills, he claimed, "That damned Swede can actually see air." Kelly later told me that Hibbard's remark was the greatest compliment he had ever received. The Skunk Works was always strictly off-limits to any outsider. I had no idea who even worked there when I reported in that first day just before Christmas 1954 to Building 82, which was an old bomber production hangar left over from World War II days. The office space allocated to Kelly's Skunk Works operation was a narrow hallway off the main production floor, crowded with drilling machines and presses, small parts assemblies, and the large assembly area which served as the production line. There were two floors of surprisingly primitive and overcrowded offices, where about 50 designers and engineers were jammed together behind as many desks as a moderate-sized room could unreasonably hold. Space was at a premium, so much so that Kelly's 10-person procurement department operated from a small balcony looking down on the production floor. The place was airless and gloomy, and had the look of a temporary campaign headquarters where all the chairs and desks were rented and disappeared the day after the vote. But there was no sense of imminent eviction apparent inside Kelly's Skunk Works. His small group were all young and high-spirited, who thought nothing of working out of a phone booth if necessary, as long as they were designing and building airplanes. Added to the eccentric flavor of the place was the fact that when the hangar doors were opened, birds would fly up the stairwell and swoop around drawing boards and dive-bomb our heads after knocking themselves silly against the permanently sealed and blacked-out windows, which Kelly insisted upon for security. Our little feathered friends were a real nuisance, but Kelly couldn't care less. All that mattered to him was our proximity to the production floor. A stone's throw was too far away. He wanted us only steps away from the shop workers to make quick structural or parts changes or answer any of their questions. All the workers had been personally recruited by Kelly from the main plant and were veterans who had worked with him before on other projects. The engineers dressed very informally, no suits or ties, because being stashed away, no one in authority except Kelly ever saw them anyway. "We don't dress up for each other," Kelly's assistant Dick Bohm told me with a laugh. I asked Dick how long I could expect to stay. He shrugged. "I don't know exactly what Kelly has in mind for you to do, but I guess anywhere from 6 weeks to 6 months." He was slightly off. I stayed for 36 years. 20 designers were stashed away in choking workrooms up on the second floor. The windows were sealed shut, and in those days nearly everyone smoked. To my delight, I was sharing an office with only 6 other engineers composing the analytical section, most of whom I discovered I already knew from my previous work on the F-104 Starfighter. Without exception, these were all colleagues whom I had particularly admired at the time. So I gave Kelly a quick A for sharp recruiting, myself excepted, of course. We were only 2 doors removed from the boss's big corner office. Before I really got to work, Bohm handed me a piece of paper on which was mimeoed Kelly's Riot Act. 10 basic rules we worked by. A few of them, there shall be only one object to get a good airplane built on time. Engineers shall always work within a stone's throw of the airplane being built. Any cause for delay shall be immediately reported to C.L. Johnson in writing by the person anticipating the delay. Special parts or materials shall be avoided whenever possible. Parts from stock shall be used, even at the expense of added weight. Otherwise, the chances of delay are too great. Everything possible will be done to save time. "For as long as you work here, this is your gospel," Dick said. Then he told me we were working with the folks at Pratt & Whitney to modify a regular jet engine to fly higher by at least 15,000 feet than any airplane had ever before flown. There were some inlet problems that I would be addressing. I knew the Russians were mediocre engine builders at least a generation behind us. I figured we were building a radically new high-flying long-range bomber. But then I was shown a drawing of the airplane, and I let out a whistle of surprise. The wings were more than 80 feet long. It looked like a glider.